Well, thank you very much for this nice introduction. Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. It's also very nice to see a number of familiar faces, people who took my class in earlier years and apparently decided that they wanted to see me again. So happy to see you all again. So this evening, what I want to talk about is issues that pertain to security and privacy in IoT. And as you might have noticed here, just a few minutes ago, we had someone who was trying to help us with some IoT technology, and he was fumbling over this device, and none of us could quite figure out how to get this device to work exactly the way we wanted. And this is actually an illustration of some of the things we're going to be talking about this evening, because IoT is in great part supposed to be managed by end users like us, right? People who are not necessarily experts in terms of these technologies, and that obviously opens some interesting issues when it comes to security and privacy. In fact, as we're going to see, these very same technologies will also come from a variety of different players, a bit like the apps on the mobile app stores. And so what I want to do today is I want to talk about lessons that we can learn from the mobile app stores and how they've evolved over the years in coping with some security and privacy issues. And as you probably know, this is not a solved problem, so it's not like mobile has been solved as far as security and privacy is concerned, but we've certainly seen what those sorts of environments give rise to in terms of security and privacy challenges, and mobile app stores over time have learned that they've got an increasing responsibility, an increasingly important role to play in terms of mitigating those risks, security risks, as well as privacy risks. And so this will be the topic of our talk today. I will use a variety of different examples, some of them coming out of research at Carnegie Mellon, to try and illustrate my point. So without any further ado, and hoping that I can get this other IoT device to work properly, but perhaps not, we're going to try. So in principle, one is supposed to click here. Right? And I guess I have to be close enough. So the IoT, what is the IoT, the Internet of Things, right? Well, the Internet of Things, as you know, is upon us already. So this is not this futuristic view of the future. Many people have Apple TVs at home. Many people have started to install smart thermostats. Many people have cameras in their homes, smart locks, smart cars, or cars are internet enabled, right? So you name it. And in fact, we are interacting with IoT devices on a pretty regular basis these days. The number of these devices will obviously continue to grow over time. There are a variety of different projections. No one can be sure that they've got the right numbers. Some people have advanced some very extravagant figures. If you look at the projections, the most recent projections, the numbers tend to hover between 20 and 30 billion devices by 2020, which is just about 3 years down the road. And so that gives you a sense for the complexity and also, obviously, the variety of devices. We only have 7 billion of people or so on this planet, right? And you can be sure that not all of us will want to have 3 cell phones, right? So those 20 billion devices will not just be smartphones. There will be a lot of variety in terms of these devices. And babies are not yet born with cell phones. There are actually people, older people, who don't have cell phones. There are people who live in poor countries and cannot necessarily afford cell phones or don't necessarily have access to the proper infrastructure. So before you know, you do the math, you realize that obviously there will have to be diversity in these devices. And you know, many of us probably already have close to 10 IoT devices in a place like Hong Kong. You just don't have only a smartphone, you have a tablet, right? You probably have a smart car perhaps, or you've got a smart TV. There are all sorts of different smart devices if you think carefully about this. And so before you know it, you've got, you know, perhaps a PlayStation, a game console. All these devices are part of IoT, as it turns out. And so that scale also is obviously a reason for concern as far as security is concerned. If these devices get compromised, they can also be the source of denial of service attacks, creating traffic levels that are basically levels that we've never seen before. And we've seen some examples of that not too long ago. So we're going to be discussing this and what it means from a practical standpoint. So while the IoT, while the Internet of Things offers lots of promises from the wearable devices that we carry and that might help us live a healthier lifestyle and become more fit, to the smart thermostats that perhaps will help us save energy and feel more comfortable in our home, ensuring that we have the right temperature, that our homes gets warmed up before we arrive back from work, or gets cool, depending on whether you live in Pittsburgh or in Hong Kong. And all that sounds very promising, but in fact, for IoT to be adopted on such a broad scale, there will be issues of security and privacy that are likely going to have to be addressed. And so that's really what I want to talk about. I want to talk about what those issues are. I want to give you a sense for the fact that this is not just talking about a future that's very far from where we are today. It's actually present. There is a clear and present danger, right, to use a familiar expression, and that has been illustrated by a number of incidents, some of which I would like to discuss this evening. And as I said, this is very reminiscent of what we have seen in the context of the mobile app economy. Right. If you remember, when the mobile app stores were introduced, they were introduced in great part because companies like Apple or Google and others realized that in order for people to buy these smartphones, they would have to have a lot of compelling content. And they didn't feel that they could actually create all these apps on their own. They didn't think that they had the manpower, the creativity, and so on, to do this on their own. And so this was all about creating incentives and creating an ecosystem that would entice a lot of different people to try and give this a shot and say, hey, perhaps I can develop an interesting app, and perhaps I'm going to become rich and a lot of people will download my app. That obviously enabled these companies, these larger ecosystem operators, right, Apple, Google, Amazon, and so on, to obviously also reduce their risk, their exposure, right? Focusing more on having an infrastructure and business models that would generate revenue independently of which app would end up being the winner, right? So these are environments where it's still very difficult to tell what the killer app is going to be. Obviously, today, in hindsight, we know a few of the killer apps in the context of mobile. And beyond email, they include, obviously, social networking apps like Facebook or apps like WeChat, right? Those are obviously, in hindsight, very popular apps. But when this all started, this wasn't entirely clear, right? And so this same business model is emerging also in the context of the Internet of Things. You have, obviously, people who are going to be willing to take, you know, these risks and say, well, we're going to try to build this device, we're going to try to build this app, we're going to try to build this service. But you also have very large ecosystems that are going to try to play this, you know, while mitigating their risk. They're going to try to leverage existing advantages that they have in the form of infrastructure, services, devices that they're already manufacturing. It's not an accident that 50% or so of all IoT scenarios today are mediated actually by smartphones, right? And so if you're a smartphone manufacturer, IoT is a natural area for you to look at and a natural area for you to try to leverage also the strategic advantage that you already have with your existing devices, with your existing services, with your existing customer base. If you're a large provider of cloud services, you're going to try to leverage that advantage, right? So there are a number of ecosystems, overlapping ecosystems, that are emerging. And what we have seen in the context of the mobile app stores is we've seen increasingly that because these app stores ultimately were about trust in great part, they were about telling people, look, you don't have to give your credit card number, right, to all these different content developers that you've never heard of. You can just give me being the App Store, your credit card, and I will ensure that it's well protected, and I am going to have a revenue model whereby people who develop content, who develop apps, will get rewarded. They're going to get a portion of the revenue, but I will also keep a fraction of that as well. And so this notion of trust has obviously been refined over time, with app developers having to take more responsibility, having to vet the quality of the apps, having to check that these apps don't contain malware. If you look at what has happened over the past few years, increasingly app stores and ecosystems like iOS or Android have effectively been a lot more proactive in trying to protect end users and also trying to help developers. A big challenge in this space has to do with the fact that if you look at typical app developers, they're typically, as I like to refer to them, two guys in a garage, and this is reflected by statistics. So there are obviously some large companies that build apps, but the vast majority of apps have been developed by one, two, three people working in very small groups, these people don't have much sophistication, whether it comes to security or privacy. So you still find today many apps that will be sending sensitive information, like location information, unencrypted. You're going to find many apps that don't have privacy policies or that have privacy policies that are actually inconsistent with what these apps are doing. And app stores increasingly are trying to make an effort, again, to lower the bar for these developers, make it easier for them to actually comply with expectations of security and privacy. And so the story of this presentation this evening is to show you those parallels also with IoT. Right. And so if you think a bit more about IoT, and if you think about the kinds of challenges that we face with, one challenge has to do with, obviously, the idea that all these devices will be connected to the Internet. And as you connect them to the Internet, they all become interoperable. They all have APIs, right? And these APIs, obviously, is what is going to help us generate value, support scenarios that would never have been, that we would not have been able to support before. But as you do that, and as you open all these APIs and support all these new usage scenarios, the attack surface that results from all this is also significantly larger and will continue to grow. Right? That means that there are many, many more possible vulnerabilities. And all it takes is effectively one component in these value chains to have a vulnerability for the bad guys to potentially be able to compromise other devices and to eventually create a lot of damage. So there are obviously issues of unauthorized access, right? Misuse of personal data that might be accessed through some of these APIs. Think about your health data. Right, you're giving your health data perhaps to your smartwatch. It's going to tell you how you might be able to improve your daily routine. Before you know it, this data might go to your health insurance company, and perhaps that's not something that you wanted to share with them. Right, and so controlling where that data goes is obviously very challenging as you have more and more APIs and as these data flows become easier and easier to support. Issues, obviously, of facilitating attacks on other systems. So when these devices are compromised, they can be hijacked, right? And they can become part of botnets, and they can start generating traffic, right? Effectively bringing potentially very substantial portions of the Internet down. And obviously, as you have more and more of these devices, right, the opportunity to generate more and more traffic also increases. And then finally, personal safety, right? So some of these devices, right, so you don't get killed by your desktop. You can definitely get killed by IoT devices, right? An example of an IoT device is a car. It could be a pacemaker, right? You've got insulin pumps that are going to go online and that are going to become part of IoT. Lots of you've got critical infrastructure. And so what we're talking about here is we're also talking about physical safety issues that are very critical. Door locks, right? You unlock a door, and before you know it, an intruder can come into your home. Right, all these issues obviously coming along with all the potential benefits of this Internet of Things. Right, and so how big of a problem are we talking about? There are certainly lots of people who think that this is a wonderful opportunity. So if you look at companies like Gartner, they're projecting that very major portions of the security budget that enterprises are going to have are going to be devoted to IoT types of issues. Right, so they're going to move towards obviously locks in offices that are going to be controlled by cell phones. You're going to be looking at video surveillance. You're going to be looking at a variety of different scenarios, right? And so the budgets that are being projected here are also very substantial. That means that the risks that come along with these technologies will likely also come along with market opportunities, opportunities for people to say, hey, I think I can potentially address this market. I can potentially address those issues. And that's good, right? You certainly want to have money. So what I'd like to illustrate is how real the danger is already today. So these are not just futuristic scenarios, and I'd like to illustrate a few of these scenarios just to perhaps make this a bit more concrete. Again, I'd like to emphasize the fact that many of the problems that we're going to look at have to do with a certain lack of sophistication. Right. Many of the products that we're going to be looking at, many of the scenarios that we're going to be looking at, reflect a combination of problems, problems that have to do with the fact that some technologies that have now become part of the Internet of Things were really not developed with security in mind, because these scenarios were just not on people's mind when some of these technologies were developed. And then before you know it, these technologies get retrofitted and they get added on the internet. And so a car is a perfect example of that, and we'll take a close look at what's going on in the automotive industry in a few minutes. We're talking about developers who are not terribly sophisticated, just with mobile apps, right? So you've got a number of initiatives. If you've got, for instance, Android Things, right, is an effort launched by Google. And it's all about enticing people to develop new IoT devices that are going to interact and basically be able to communicate via a number of APIs that Google is planning to grow over time. That's all wonderful, but who are these people who are going to build these devices? The vision is that those people will not just be the large players, the Ciscos and Intels of the world. The idea is that, you know, someone again in their garage might come up with a great idea, right? They're going to buy an Arduino, or they're going to buy a Raspberry Pi. They're going to build a little sensor. They're going to connect this. They're going to use these APIs that Android Things is making available. And before you know it, you know, maybe one of those devices will turn out to be extremely successful. You know, 10,000 of them might be, you know, complete failures, but one of them might be extremely successful. You might sell millions of them, right? And before you know it, you might find that, boy, there's a vulnerability with this device. What do we do? Do these guys really have the sophistication as they build these things in their garage and they're driven by some particular usage scenario that they've come up with? Are they really going to be able to deal with the security challenges that come along with, you know, deploying this device on the scale of millions of such devices in many homes or many other types of environments? Chances are they don't have that sophistication. They need help. They will need help from these ecosystems, as I've mentioned. And so this is very similar, as I said, to the app stores. So I'd like to illustrate this clear and present danger with three examples. One is car hacking, and one is home device hacking, and the other one deals with sort of this scenario where everyone becomes an IoT developer, and that's what we're seeing in the context of this environment. If this, then that. So I see a few students in my class who are saying, yes, we've discussed that in class. Yes, indeed, we have. So try to bear with me, if you don't mind. There will be other things that we've not discussed. So I don't know if some of you have noticed the headlines. This is something that was well publicized at DEF CON over the past couple of years. DEF CON is obviously, as you know, one of the key security conferences these days. And a couple of guys were basically able to demonstrate how they were able to hack a Jeep. Now, we've known for a number of years that cars in general can be hacked, but what was interesting in these demos is that they were able to hack these cars remotely. That means they didn't have to actually plug into any of the devices in the car. And so this was back in July of 2015, and as I said, this was done remotely, and the exploit in this particular case was a relatively benign exploit in some ways, and that involved playing with the air conditioning, the stereo in the car, and other things of that nature. And as a result of that, Jeep Chrysler recalled 1.4 million vehicles, so not too bad. But a year later, these guys came back again at DEF CON, right? So this was basically now in August of 2016, so this is just about 7 months ago, right, or 6 months ago. And basically these guys showed actually tricks that were a lot scarier, right? So in a way, they really wanted to shake the industry up, because things have not been moving very, very fast in the automotive industry. And honestly, I can understand why, because they've got a huge headache in their hands, right? Perhaps they should recall all the vehicles that are on the road today. That would probably be the right thing to do. And that may not be something that they can necessarily afford. So you can see why they might be dragging their feet. And at the same time, we're talking about people's lives here. And so you'd say, it doesn't matter, right? A person's life is worth a lot more than your bottom line. So these guys here, right, they were able to basically exploit something called the CAN bus, and I'll explain how that works in a minute. And they were able now to not just play with the stereo and the wipers and a few other things of that nature. They were able to play with the brakes. They were able to play with the steering wheel. They were able to play with the accelerator. They were pretty much able to do anything they wanted with these cars, which obviously becomes very scary, right? So you can potentially have someone driving at 100 kilometers an hour on the freeway, and then, you know, perhaps you get the car to do a 180-degree turn, right, in real time, and good luck with that. So these are the kinds of things. So how did they do this? Well, they took advantage, and this is the big problem, they took advantage of a vulnerability in the cellular connection with the car. That means the way the equipment that was responsible for connecting the car to the cellular network. Right, there was a vulnerability in this equipment. The problem with the design of all the cars that are on the road today, except cars that were built before 1985 or so, but every car that has been built between 1985 and today has this sort of problem. And the problem is the following. The problem is that they rely on something called a controller area network. And this controller area network, this CAN bus, is basically the way in which the architecture of cars has evolved over the past 25 years. It's the idea that as we basically place more and more computer-controlled equipment in these cars, from your brakes being controlled by computers to the steering, to sensors to check the pressure in your tires, to the audio system that you have, to the wipers, and the airbags, and the seat belts, and you continue, right? I mean, I can go on and on. Everything is controlled by a computer today. What they decided to do is they decided that clearly they could not have a point-to-point type of architecture where they would hardwire every two components that had to connect to talk to one another. Instead, they would build an extensible architecture that would rely on a bus, and that bus would effectively be responsible for conveying all the traffic that would flow between various components in a car. Not a bad idea in principle, right? But what that also means is that effectively the way all these components talk to one another today is they're basically shouting all on this bus, and there is really no partitioning of this bus. That means that this is the same bus that's going to be used by the audio system, right, to talk to the speakers, and the same system is used also for you to talk to the brakes and to the accelerometer the accelerator and the wipers and the airbags and so on. And so what that means is that all you need to do is compromise one of these many devices that you have in a car, right? Like, for instance, the stereo system. You compromise the stereo system, and now you've got access to this CAN bus. And you can start shouting commands on that CAN bus. And if you shout them in the right format, like the format that the brakes understand, the brakes will say, oh, I've got to brake, or I've got to stop braking. Or the steering wheel might say, oh, I've got to turn 180 degrees. Or the accelerator might have to say, oh, I've got to accelerate to 100 kilometers an hour. Right. So now, basically, any one of these components that you've got in a car, and as we all realize, there are more and more such components, right, any one of these components can, in principle, talk to any other component. And all they need to do is they need to figure out what the right format is. And those formats, as it turns out, are not terribly difficult to figure out. Why? Because, again, all you need to do is you need to have access to this CAN bus. You can, for instance, buy the car if you wanted to, right? You buy the car, and then you start listening to traffic, like you turn on, you know, the wipers, and you see what sort of message is being sent, and you, you know, go and press the brake pedal, and you see what sort of message. Before you know it, you figure out the format, right? And then you can hijack these things remotely, right? And you can send all sorts of commands. And so that's what we're dealing with. This architecture is present on all cars on the road today, any car that has been built since about 1985, right? So how is that for scary? Well, so what are the root causes of this problem? The root causes are that this architecture was a very open architecture. They didn't segregate components on this CAN bus. They didn't say, well, there's no reason for the audio system to talk to the brakes. It would probably be a good idea to say, well, the audio system should just never be able to speak to the brakes. End of the story, right? But they didn't do that. They don't have an architecture to deal with that. They're not trying to authenticate these components, right? So the stereo system can start playing, pretending that it's actually the controller for the brakes, right? The brakes have no ID because there is no authentication. There's no signed messages, nothing of that nature, right? There is no encryption. That means that you can intercept messages and you can modify them. So a command to turn the wheel by, you know, 5 degrees could be changed into a command to turn the wheel by 180 degrees. right? No encryption whatsoever. And then finally, security by obfuscation. So these car manufacturers have been thinking they were very smart by thinking that, you know, as long as we don't publish our formats, nobody will be able to compromise these things, except all you need to do is just eavesdrop on the communication. Right. So how do we go about fixing these things? Well, again, if you want to fix something like this, right, you've got to obviously, right, this is not something that you're going to say, we're going to fix this, we Chrysler are going to fix this on our own, or we Toyota are going to fix this on our own. You're not, because obviously a very large number of components that go into these cars are components that go into multiple cars manufactured by multiple companies, right? So the Jeeps, right, and the Toyotas and other brands, right, they're potentially all using similar types of audio systems, right, or similar types of wipers. And so you need to agree on standards, right, in this area. You need to have these large players come together and agree on standards that are going to include security boundaries. So there's no reason, again, for the brakes to talk to the stereo in your car, encryption, authentication, authorization, and then eventually a process also to certify these components. Now, it's never going to be foolproof, right? But at least with these measures in place, right, you would hope that you're going to mitigate those risks. Today is just way too easy to create problems in this space. So very, very scary stuff. Now let's take another example, completely different example. Let's look at home devices, right? So many people these days, you know, most of us have wireless routers at home, I assume. Many of us have smart TVs, right? A number of people have also cameras and all sorts of other things, and these cameras are not just in homes, but certainly you go into a restaurant, you go, you know, into a coffee shop, you go into a laundromat, right? You've got cameras everywhere for security reasons. So this just happened in October, right? So this is very, very recent. So in October of 2016, right, a botnet that, as far as we know, included about 600,000 IoT devices that had been compromised by a virus called Mirai. This is a virus that's basically attacking IoT devices specifically, Linux-based IoT devices, and turns them into basically computers on a botnet. And once you commandeer these botnets, you can basically get them to launch, you know, to send traffic to whatever, you know, computers or servers you want them to send traffic to. And so the way in which this particular attack, and this is very common for these denial, these decentralized denial of service attacks, the way you go at launching these attacks, if you want them to be very effective, is you go after the choke points on the internet. So you don't necessarily launch all this traffic at a particular website. Instead, you go after DNS servers, right? And the DNS servers, as you know, are the places, so there are very large DNS services, in particular this DIN DNS service is a very major one, right? And so they basically swamped these DNS servers with traffic to the point that legitimate traffic was unable to get any sort of response. And as a result, many different websites were actually brought down. The traffic that we're talking about here was in the order of over 1 terabyte per second, if that means anything to you. So 1 terabyte per second. A terabyte is basically, if you fill the memory on your laptop, and if you've got a good laptop with lots of memory, you've got a terabyte, right? That's what you send in 1 second, right? So imagine that sort of traffic hitting your DNS servers, right? So that obviously was a major problem. But if we look at this a bit more deeply, so why is it that so many of these devices were compromised? Why is it that this Mirai virus was so successful at creating this botnet of 600,000 IoT devices? Well, here's an illustration. So in case you're reading the Wall Street Journal, this article actually came out today, right? So they're still talking about this attack today, right? How many of you have seen this article? Right, so this just came out this morning, basically. Right, so computer viruses are harnessing webcams, thermostats, and other connected devices while owners remain in the dark. And so if you read this article, they actually went and identified one of the laundromats that had a security camera that was compromised and that was part of this botnet. And they said, well, let's, you know, see and find out how this actually happened, right? Didn't this person who owns the laundromat notice something wrong? Right? And the answer is no, the owner didn't notice anything because the camera continued to work. Occasionally, a camera would crash, but what this Mirai virus does is it doesn't fully disable the device. It basically takes a portion of the computing power and a portion, obviously, of the traffic that this device is able to generate to effectively start infecting other devices. And eventually, when the botnet is large enough and it's told to launch an attack, it launches the attack. But this owner had no idea. She noticed that regularly the camera would crash, but she learned that all she had to do was to restart the camera. And then she would restart the camera, and the camera would work again for a while. Eventually, she forgot her password. And so the beauty about this is that the manufacturers of these cameras learned that lots of people forget their passwords, and they didn't have the manpower to handle these phone calls. So what they did is they said, well, if people cannot log in after a while, we'll just reset to the default password automatically. Default password is 123456, right? And it's well known, right? It's not like it's hidden. So the password is 123456. So guess how difficult it is to compromise that particular device, right? So the interesting thing is that this camera was not installed by the owner of the laundromat. So this person obviously didn't have the technical skills. Certainly she didn't have the technical skills to even notice that something was wrong with her camera. There was actually a security person who you'd think would be a bit more sophisticated, was actually responsible for installing this camera. And this person found out about the attack after being contacted by journalists, right? So that gives you a sense for the level of sophistication that people who deploy these devices have, right? This is a typical example, right? And so when you have this level of, and obviously the manufacturer denies having anything to do with this problem, right? The fact that they're resetting the password, you know, why would they have any responsibility, right? So basically, this is a very typical situation, right? This is a device manufacturer who has limited resources, didn't invest an awful lot of time and effort in security. These are people who are obviously not terribly sophisticated. They operate a laundromat, right? How much computer expertise do you need to operate a laundromat? Not an awful lot. And so this is a very typical example of a deployment, but also of the development of an IoT device, right? And so that illustrates how much of a headache we might have ahead of us as we're dealing with very massive amounts, very massive numbers of devices like this, right, being manufactured, you know, by relatively small players who are not terribly sophisticated, being deployed by even less sophisticated players, right, who are just unable, right, to properly manage these devices, right? So, again, how do you deal with that? Well, this is, again, something that these little manufacturers, these unsophisticated people who deploy the devices or operate the device, these are not problems that these people are going to solve. Right? What is needed here is a need. There's a need for help. Right? There's a need as you try to get this IoT sort of world to flourish, there's a need to lower the bar in terms of the level of expertise that's required from all these people without compromising security. Right, so Cisco actually picked up on this, and they developed a proposal which is now under review by the IETF. And their proposal is considered is called MUD or MUD, right? And it stands for it's basically a description of the behavior of the device. And I might have this on the next slide, so. Perhaps manufacturer usage description. All right, so there we go. So as I said, the problem here has to do with unsophisticated developers, device manufacturers, and sophisticated users. And Cisco, as I said, has come up with a proposal, at least, for dealing with this particular issue. And the idea is the following. The idea is that you're going to, whenever you manufacture a device, you're going to also publish a profile for that device. In this case, in an XML format. And that profile will tell you what this device is supposed to do as far as legitimate traffic is concerned. What sort of traffic patterns are you supposed to observe when this device is operating? Right. So is this camera supposed to communicate with your bank? Or is this camera supposed to communicate with Twitter? Probably not. Right. The sort of traffic that you want to see from this camera is traffic that's going to go to a monitoring station. That's typically how that works, right? And so you could specify, right, that this is the behavior that you're expecting to see from this device. This is the IP address or the port, right? And this is the traffic that you're supposed to see. And you're going to publish this almost like as a, you know, not exactly an identity card, but more like a card describing the typical behavior that's associated with this device. You're going to provide this in a declarative format. And then when the user or somebody else installs this device, you know, in their laundromat or their home or what have you, they're basically going to have a URL that's going to be tied to this device, and the URL will point to this XML file. The XML file will then be downloaded, and it's going to describe basically a policy. The user doesn't have to know anything about this policy. This is all going to take place behind the curtains, right? But this policy will be incorporated into your Wi-Fi router in the form of its overall privacy, its overall security policy. And therefore, this controller will be, you know, doing its job, which involves monitoring traffic and blocking things that are not legit, blocking things that have not been declared in that MUD profile that was basically downloaded at the time this device was installed. Right. So this is one way in which you can effectively lower the bar for the end user. How do you lower the bar for the manufacturer? Well, you develop tools that make it very easy for them to describe what their devices are supposed to do. You have templates, and before you know it, they don't need a huge amount of sophistication to start supporting that. So that's an example, again, where you can hope to help people lower the bar in terms of the level of sophistication that's required from them to mitigate potential security problems. So the third example I want to discuss is an example that deals with everyone becoming an IoT developer. So there is this framework, there are actually a number of frameworks like this, but there's this framework called If This Then That that has gained quite a bit in popularity. And this is about enabling everyone and their brothers to become IoT developers by writing very simple rules that will effectively enable them to sense some result coming out of one service or one device, and when that result occurs, when that event occurs, trigger another action, potentially with a different service or a different device. Right? And so in this case, right, the kinds of scenarios that we're talking about, and I'll show you a few examples of those scenarios, include things such as, you know, whenever the weather says it's raining, send me a reminder to take my umbrella when I leave home. Right, that could be an example of a scenario. Anyone, right, can pretty much write this if there's an API to access the weather service and read whether or not, you know, the weather says that it's going to be raining, and then all you need to do is send a predefined text message, and there's an API to send text, right, both for Android and iOS, as it turns out. So this environment here has actually a number of APIs. These APIs are provided by people who say, I want to join this ecosystem. Here is my API. So you've got a number of device manufacturers, Belkin, for instance, light bulbs, right, thermostats, and so on. Belkin has made a number of IoT APIs available within this context. iOS and Android have made a number of APIs available. And before you know it, you've got people who've been able to write very simple rules, right? Anyone can do that. How many of those do you have? You have something. So these are examples, right, of real services. There's actually a website where people share these recipes, as they're called, these rules, right? And there's about, I think, 300,000 of those rules that are being shared today. And there's something like over 1 million active users, apparently. So 1.2 million active users on a daily basis and 400,000 shared recipes. So these recipes, as you can see, are trivial, right? It's like change your Android wallpaper to NASA's image of the day. So every day you access, you know, NASA's image, and you issue a command to update your wallpaper. Why? Because there's an API for that, right? So know that there's an API for that. You don't need to be a programmer to actually do this, right? So those are the kinds of things that people do. It's easy to understand that as you have all these APIs, right, developers will run into problems because they're not really developers. They're users. They're everyday users. They've got no idea about privacy and security and how the information they're passing across these APIs is going to be leaked or how it's going to eventually result in some sort of a security breach. Right. So that's, again, an example where these ecosystems are going to have to basically up their game and start doing things on behalf of users, because users themselves are just not going to be able to be sophisticated enough to deal with these kinds of issues. There's a paper actually that's going to be published, I believe, next month by colleagues of mine, where they've actually analyzed many of these recipes and found that 50% of them have potential security or privacy issues. But this has not been published yet. It's only going to be published next month, so I'm not going to say more about that. That's their work. So there's a very similar situation when it comes to privacy, as it turns out, right? So privacy with all these IoT devices is an equally challenging problem, right? So just like people who develop these apps or develop these IoT devices are not terribly sophisticated when it comes to security, they also lack the expertise to really deal with privacy. It means they're typically unable to write a privacy policy, and they're typically also not necessarily capable of making sure that their code is compliant with whatever privacy policy they might potentially have written. Right? And so privacy is becoming also increasingly complex for us as end users. In fact, today, most of us have already pretty much given up on trying to control our privacy. And it's not for lack of interest in privacy. I could do a show of hands, and we would quickly realize that all of us care about privacy. I just did that in class yesterday, and the students will certainly say yes, correct. Everybody was actually concerned about privacy. It's very easy to come up with scenarios that people will respond to. They're going to say, oh, I've got a problem with that. I would certainly not be willing to share my data under that context. Those contexts might vary from one person to another, but I can give you two or three scenarios, and there's a pretty much 100% chance that at least one of those three scenarios would be concerning to you. Right, so everybody cares about privacy, but at the same time, very few people take the time to read privacy policies. I mean, we can do the same show of hands that we did in class yesterday. So how many of you have read a privacy policy over the past year? Right. Okay, how about a fraction of a privacy policy? Right, so many. Okay, so right, the vast majority of the people in this room have not even read a fraction of a privacy policy over the past year. Right, and I can come up with more examples like that. The next example I like to use is to see whether people know what information their apps on their cell phones have access to. And, maybe there's someone in my class who's recently looked, but I'm willing to bet that otherwise nobody knows. Right. So people care about privacy, but by and large, they feel overwhelmed today. It's very, very difficult for people to just cope with all those different data flows and really take the time to configure things so that you are, in fact, in an environment where all the settings are aligned with your preferences. Right. So 91%, this is a Pew survey in the United States, right? I'm sure we would get very similar results here in Hong Kong. 91% of people report feeling they have lost control over their information, which is what privacy is all about. Right, so more concrete examples, right? If you look at your cell phone, if you've got 50 apps on your cell phone, which is very common for people, if you've got apps that on average require 3 permissions, that's a total of 150 settings that you would have to configure. Nobody has the time to do that, right? And if you look at IoT technology, it's even more complicated, right? Because IoT, you don't even see IoT. The apps you've got on your cell phone, presumably you downloaded them at some point. So you have some knowledge of the fact that these apps exist, right? IoT, you enter a room and you don't really know what's in that room, right? You can't really tell. Yet there are cameras that are collecting information about you. You go into a mall these days, there are tons of malls here in Hong Kong, right, that are trying to track your whereabouts. They're basically sensing unique device IDs using Wi-Fi, MAC addresses, Bluetooth, there are cameras, right? All this technology is being deployed today because these malls are trying to better understand, you know, what your interests are. They want to send you the right coupon and what have you, right? Except that we don't see these things in the first place. So how are we to even know what privacy policy comes along with that, right? How long do they, you know, keep this information that they're collecting? They're doing facial recognition? Facial recognition, as you know, is very easy to do these days. Extremely accurate, right? So what do you know? They might very well be doing facial recognition. They might be able to link you to a profile that they might have built about you, right? So all these things are obviously very challenging, especially as we're moving into an environment where you're going to have a wider variety of people contributing to this ecosystem, developing apps, developing devices, and so on. Okay, so what is needed? Well, what is needed is, at a high level, as I said, technology again in privacy that's going to help developers and manufacturers, that's going to help them have privacy policies, expose their privacy settings. You want to minimize, ultimately, the likelihood that someone is going to be surprised that as they walked into this mall, all this information about them got collected. They just don't necessarily realize that this is happening, but that would certainly be the better practice. So how do you help developers articulate privacy policies and disclose these privacy policies when the devices are not visible? How do you help also users manage all this complexity? Right, if you enter a room and there are 10 different devices that are monitoring you at some level, right, and even if some of these devices offer you a few settings, how do you go about configuring all these settings? You don't even take the time to configure the settings on your mobile phone, so what are the chances you're going to configure settings in an IoT sort of environment? Very, very low, right? So let me tell you about a few technologies that are being developed today at Carnegie Mellon that are intended to try and help address those types of issues. So the first technology I want to talk about is a technology that can effectively identify potential privacy violations. So suppose that you're an app developer and that you're writing a privacy policy. Right? There's a very decent chance that this privacy policy, assuming that you've written one, so I'm going to show you many people should write privacy policies and don't even write them. But even if you have written a privacy policy, there's a very decent chance that this privacy policy is inaccurate and could get you in trouble. So how could we help developers write privacy policies that are better aligned with what their app actually does, and more generally do the same thing for IoT? So the tool that I'm going to talk about is a tool that has been deployed. We've actually piloted this tool with the California Office of the Attorney General. They're very interested in enforcing their own online privacy policy, which is known as CALOPA, the California Online Privacy Protection Act. This is a technology that does two things. It's technology that relies on natural language processing to read the text of privacy policies and understand what these privacy policies do. We've actually been able to, over the years, to develop technology that's pretty good at doing that, as it turns out. And then we have developed another technology. And this other technology reads the code of your app, and it looks at what the app does. And then we compare the two, and we find discrepancies. And so if you're an app developer, I can use this technology to say, hey, you forgot to say that you're sharing your location with Google, or you're forgetting to tell the user that you're forgetting to disclose the fact that you're sharing, you know, the contacts list with Facebook. Right? Those are the kinds of things that many developers, as it turns out, forget. Right. So this tool today is able to do a number of different things. It's able to automatically detect whether or not there's a privacy policy. That's not terribly complicated, but it's not as trivial as it may sound, because the privacy policy could be in a number of different places. It could be on the App Store, it could be within the app, it could be on a website. So there are multiple places where you need to look, and then you need to see, is this actually a privacy policy? We're actually able to do that very well. But beyond that, it's also able to look at things such as, is this policy disclosing, for instance, whether or not location information is being collected? Is it disclosing whether location information is being shared? Is it disclosing whether a unique identifier is being collected or shared? Right, and a bunch of other things of that nature. Is it disclosing when the policy is going to be changed? Or is there a notice to users in terms of what their rights are to delete their information? If you delete your account, do you also get to delete your information? Do you get to review the information that the company has collected, which is a requirement here in Hong Kong, right? Under the Hong Kong Data Privacy Ordinance, one of the rights that you have as an end user is you have the right to request access to data that has been collected about you, right? And then within 40 days, the entity that has collected that data has to give you access to this data, right? So what does the policy say about this, right? So those are the kinds of things that we're able to automatically detect, right? And so just to give you a sense for the state of affairs today and give you a sense for how bad things are, and this is in the mobile app space, but you can imagine that the same applies also to IoT. So we did an analysis of 20,000 apps about a year ago or so. We automatically scanned the Google Play Store. We're actually at a stage now where we can automatically scan the whole App Store on a monthly basis. It takes us about 6 seconds to analyze an app. That's how fast this technology works, right? And in comparison, regulators have been trying to do the same thing. And once a year, they get together. A number of different regulatory agencies come together, and they try to analyze as many apps as they can. In February of 2014, they did that, and they were able to scan 1,200 apps, which is, very impressive. These are human beings. We were able to analyze 18,000 apps in 30 hours. So that's obviously a lot more efficient. So here are some of the things we found as we looked at these things. We found, for instance, So under CALOPA, this California Online Privacy Protection Act, we can customize this technology. But under CALOPA, a mobile app needs to have, or any sort of internet technology, needs to have a privacy policy if it collects sensitive data, such as information or unique device ID. Right. So when we look at the code of an app, if an app collects this type of information, and if it doesn't have a privacy policy, that's a violation. We can flag that. So just looking at that, we found that, number one, half of the apps that we looked at, this was a random sample, half of the apps that we looked at, 48%, didn't have a privacy policy. And among those 48%, 71% of them were actually collecting sensitive information. So right there, we found basically 6,000 apps out of 18,000 were actually already in violation of CALOPA. But we went beyond that, and I'm not going to bore you with lots of results, but these are examples of results that you come up with. So, for instance, when it comes to the sharing, S stands for sharing, of unique device ID, I didn't explain these acronyms in much detail, we found that only 10% of the apps with privacy policy. So this is looking at the ones that have a policy. The ones that don't have a policy, there's nothing we can say because they don't have a policy. But the ones that have a policy, only 10% of them disclose sharing unique device ID, while 71% actually collect this information. So right there, there's a very high likelihood that 61% of these apps are also in violation. Location, about 8% of the apps fail to disclose the sharing of location. Right. Under CALOPA, not only you need to have a privacy policy when you share location, but you also need to disclose it. The same for unique device ID. Right? So if these statements are missing from the privacy policy and the code shows that you're doing that, again, you've got a violation. So how can you use this technology? Well, obviously, there's a lot of interest from regulators to use this technology, but that's not the ideal scenario. We're going to make this technology available to regulators because that looks very good to our sponsors. Our sponsor is the government, right? But we ultimately want to make this technology available to developers, right? We don't want people to get the regulator to fall on them. We'd like to help people not have the regulator fall on them. That would be much better, right? And so there are actually ways of deploying this very same technology and make it available to developers, and we're looking at that as we speak here. We would like to also help app stores. In fact, we strongly believe that app stores are the ones that have to offer this technology. So this technology could be embedded, for instance, in an IDE, right? So app developers in Android, what do they use? They use Android Studio, right? You could actually embed this technology in the form of a plugin in Android Studio and help developers as they write their privacy policy to say, hey, your code is doing this, but your policy doesn't disclose it. You should really disclose it, right? And all of a sudden, you would see privacy policies of higher quality. Right. The app stores themselves, once people submit their apps, could sort of verify that these apps, in fact, have privacy policies that are consistent with what the code is doing. Right. Again, I strongly believe the app stores have so much more resources. If you look at a company like Google, right, that's running the Android Play Store, you look at a company like Amazon, or you look at a company like Apple, these guys are sophisticated. They've got massive resources. Right. They've got huge economies of scale, right, in contrast to the developer who's built just one app. Right, they've got 2 million apps each. Right, that's an economy of scale. They can afford to build these tools, and they can afford to make them available to developers. Right, so continuing here and talking about maybe more the end user side of this. So I've talked about trying to help developers when it comes to privacy, but I've not really told you how to help end users. So how do I help this poor end user as he or she, you know, moves into a building, a room, takes the subway or goes into the mall, and you've got, you know, all these different devices collecting information about him or her, right? Well, I'm sure some of you have seen these signs, right? So these signs are actually in many places. How often do you see these signs, right, when they're there? Most of us don't see these signs, right? So a couple of months ago, I was at this conference called RSA. RSA is like the biggest security conference. And it takes place at the Moscone Center in San Francisco. It's a huge convention center. And they've got this huge exhibit hall, actually two of them, where all the vendors basically advertise their products. And so you go down the escalator, and you get into this huge exhibit hall. And somewhere in the middle of that room, right, and this is a huge room, right, we're talking about tens and tens of thousands of square feet, right, somewhere in the middle of this room, there's a sign like this, right? How many people see that sign? Not too many, right? So how do we effectively move beyond that, right? How do we get your cell phone to say, hey, you're under surveillance, And should we even tell you? I mean, you're all smiling, and you're smiling because it's like, yeah, there are cameras everywhere. I know that. I don't care to be notified about this. So how do we deal with that? How do we deal with technology that's smart enough to tell you about those things that you care about, and that's not going to bother you every 2 minutes because there's yet another IoT device doing something that either you don't care about because it doesn't bother you, or something that you already expect anyway, even if it bothers you. It's like, okay, I've grown accustomed to it. I know there's nothing I can do about it. Don't, you know, bother telling me about this because you're going to be wasting my time. Right. So we've actually developed an infrastructure for that. Right. And I will show you how this infrastructure works in a few minutes. So we're probably going to spend another 10 minutes. So hopefully you have a little bit of extra time here. So we've developed an infrastructure for this. So this infrastructure enables people who deploy IoT resources like cameras, smart sensors, thermostats, applications, and so on. It enables these people to advertise the presence of these services and their privacy policies. And it enables people to discover the presence of these services, these resources, because they're going to download on their cell phone an app that we call a privacy assistant. And this privacy assistant, as you roam around, will be discovering these registries. This is working today, right? It's able to use protocols that we've developed to discover these registries, to query these registries to find out resources that are in your vicinity. And based on preferences that it has learned about you, it's going to selectively warn you about things that you care to know about, and it's going to remain silent about all these things that you don't care about or that you already know. And so our vision for this is that this assistant should only perhaps, you know, interrupt you 3 or 4 times during the course of the day. Not more than that. We don't want to be disrupted more than that. Privacy becomes very annoying if we get disrupted more than that. But occasionally, you know, if you pass in front of a camera that doesn't only do, you know, facial recognition, but also does facial expression recognition, or does iris scans, right, which can potentially reveal health problems, as it turns out. You can do iris scans for an amazing distance these days, right? A lot of things, there are lots of things that are happening today that people don't realize. Or if you worked in London, as they had a couple of summers ago, and you've got trash cans with cameras that are observing you, maybe that's something that you'd want to know about. Or you walk into a store where the mannequin actually is outfitted with cameras, and it's looking at how long you look at it, or, you know, smart windows in shopping windows that are watching, you know, what item you're looking at and what is your age and gender and, you know, whether or not they think that you're making a lot of money or very little money. I mean, these things actually exist today. Those are the scenarios that you'd want to know about, right? Those are the scenarios that you don't really expect, right, that you've not come across before or that potentially bother you, right? And those are the scenarios that you'd want to be warned about that might potentially result in you changing your behavior, or if there were any settings available, and we don't expect a huge number of settings, but there will be settings over time, right? You might potentially want to configure these settings. You might say, hey, I really don't want this camera to do facial expression recognition, and there's a setting to turn that off. I'm going to have my assistant automatically request that this setting be switched off. We have APIs for that we've developed along with these registries. So that's how this works, and I'll show you an example of this in a minute. So the kinds of things that we've developed as part of this infrastructure includes the registries. There are portals that we've developed for people who own these resources that enable these people, without much sophistication, to quickly declare the presence of these resources. In fact, for off-the-shelf products like your Nest thermostat or your Microsoft Kinect or your Amazon Echo, we actually have templates. So all you need to do is you need to say, basically, I'm installing an Amazon Echo at home, and the template automatically gets downloaded in your registry. You don't have to do anything. Right? That's effectively how easy we want these things to be. Just like the MUD architecture that Cisco has developed for security. We've got protocols to advertise the presence of these things. We've got an underlying privacy policy language where you can describe all sorts of different things. This is all developed. So it includes what information are you collecting, how long are you going to retain that information, are you anonymizing the information, are you aggregating the information, you know, among several people, in time, in terms of location, protocols for discovery and querying, protocols to configure settings, and privacy assistance. All that actually exists today. Right. So this is research funded by Google under the IoT Expedition, and also funded by the National Science Foundation and DARPA. So those are examples of screens that, as a system administrator, you can walk through, right, where you can declare a new resource if you want to do it manually. If this is a new resource that doesn't exist, not a commercial resource, there are a number of screens. This is the workflow that you go through in defining one of these resources. And this console is very flexible, so it doesn't force you to define everything. We understand that not everybody will want to define everything up front, and so you can decide what you want to declare. If you want to be fairly vague, that's up to you, right? Obviously, if there are laws that require you to be more specific, then you better comply with these laws. But we're not trying to force anything on people at this point. So we're declaring what data is being collected, at what level of granularity, for what purpose are you collecting this information. So are you going to be sharing this information with advertisers or not? Are you going to share this with marketing? Are you going to do data mining on that? All these sorts of things can actually easily be specified. And these are the privacy assistants. So these exist basically for Android phones and iOS phones today. And these are examples of settings. So these settings are automatically being displayed. If you discover there's a resource with settings, right, this is going to be displayed in your assistant, and your assistant will be told about the API to use to basically request that the system be configured in a particular way for you. Right, this can already be done. Right, so what I thought I would do is I thought I would show you a video of this system in action. Right, and so I've been speaking a lot, and so I thought that perhaps you deserve seeing something else than just me speaking again. And invalid source, which we knew that, so we are prepared. Just bear with me. So this video is actually here, and so here we go.
Purpose to inform the inhabitants of the building about the information captured by Timbers. For that, Bob, the building manager, defines this information through the Internet of Things Resource Registry, or the IRR.
We're building an infrastructure that will enable resource owners to declare the presence of their resources in different spaces, along with the privacy practices associated with these resources. What data they collect, for what purpose, how long they retain that data, to what extent they aggregate or anonymize that data, and to what extent they have settings that they're willing to make available to users.
The IoT Resource Registry enables system administrators to register new IoT resources and modify the descriptions of existing IoT resources, such as IoT applications, services, or virtual sensors. First, Bob authenticates with the registry's portal and now proceeds to declare both the resource and the service. Next, he registers the service that will make use of the Wi-Fi location tracking system. He can add a link to allow people to download the app right from their privacy assistant. Bob continues on by registering the resource used by the service. After that, he gives some context information about where the data is collected and who is responsible for it. He's not required to fill out every field, but users will appreciate knowing who is collecting their data. Notice that the interface does not require any programming. Instead, Bob interacts with a predefined set of questions and drop-down menus that enable him to quickly declare his new resource. The process can be interrupted at any time, with the user saving the information that he's entered. Bob can then later come back and resume the process, including modifying entries that he specified earlier. The overall workflow associated with the definition of a new IoT resource is shown at the top of the screen, enabling Bob to visualize his progress and keep track of tasks that he still needs to complete. At a high level, the different steps involved in defining a resource each correspond to a screen. For example, how the data is used, how long it will be retained, who it's shared with, and what settings or controls are made available to the end users, if any. For instance, if Bob's location tracking resource includes an opt-out setting, he can seamlessly specify this setting in the registry. Users, as they later discover Bob's service, will then, via their privacy assistant, be able to request the opt-out location tracking. In practice, this is done using APIs that connect the functionality capable of enforcing these settings. This functionality might be embedded in the resource itself, or can be supported by deploying a policy enforcement gateway in front of the repository used to collect the data. Our architecture supports both of these configurations.
Mary is a professor at UCI's Computer Science Department. Today, she is scheduling the thesis proposal of her PhD student. Mary uses the Noodle application to set up the meeting. She includes information, such as the room where it will take place, the time and date, Participants, including John, an external member of the CMEO, and documents, including a preliminary draft of the thesis. Also, she selects different policies regarding the meeting. For example, the video and audio should be recorded, but the document should only be available for participants. On the day of the thesis proposal, John arrives in DBH. The moment he gets close to the building, his smartphone notifies him about tippers.
Along with this technology, we're building privacy assistance that will reside on people's mobile phones initially, and that will enable users as they roam around to discover relevant registries, query these registries, and find out about resources deployed in these spaces that are collecting data about them.
The privacy assistant displays the presence of the location tracking functionality as well as the location sharing service available to people who are in Bren Hall.
John uses the newly discovered app, Concierge, to find the room where the thesis proposal will take place. For that, he searches the room, and Concierge displays its location on the floor plan. He also gives information associated to the meeting. John follows the directions of Concierge to reach the room. He discovers in Concierge that there is a coffee machine on the floor and decides to grab coffee on his tray. The thesis proposal is about to start in 5 minutes, and Mary wants to know if John is nearby. Concierge also enables residents of the building to find others. Mary uses Concierge to find John. She realizes that he's been in the coffee room for a while now. Mary calls John and tells him that the proposal is about to start, and there's no need to stop the coffee machine because there is coffee ready for him. John realizes that the information captured by the building can be used to track him. He is not fine with others having access to his precise location, but he wants Mary to know that he is on his way.
John notices through the privacy assistant the availability of an opt-out setting. He's not terribly comfortable making his location available to others on campus, but decides to submit an opt-out request via his privacy assistant. The request is forwarded to tippers, and that enforces the new policy.
Mary is still using Concierge to track John. However, tippers is now taking into account John's privacy preference. So, Concierge shows that John is somewhere in the first floor. John finally reaches the room, and the proposal can now start.
Okay, so that gives you a sense for how that works, right? And so obviously this is a bit of a cooked up scenario, but this is actually deployed, right? So if you look today, we've deployed this at Carnegie Mellon, we've deployed this at UC Irvine, so this is a different campus, a completely different set of sensors and infrastructure, and we're getting ready now to basically also enable people to download templates that correspond to off-the-shelf devices. The other side of this is to learn people's preferences. So in this scenario here, John was actually configuring these settings manually, and you still need all these protocols that I've talked about to make this work. And we've done this for a variety of other types of scenarios. We've got, for instance, facial obfuscation in the context of video streaming. We've played with a number of different things. I don't have the time to show you that. This is an example of a mobile app that's available today on the Google Play Store. That basically builds on the learning of people's privacy preferences when it comes to disclosing or granting permissions to mobile apps. So this is actually working. This is based on learning that we've done. We've shown that basically if we ask people between 3 and 5 questions, we can predict the vast majority of their permissions. And so we can provide them with recommendations, or we can potentially configure this for them. So as I said, we've got also off-the-shelf IoT devices for which we've been building templates. And so the name of the game is to eventually also provide tools to developers and manufacturers of IoT devices so that they themselves can start building these templates for end users to then download, or for this whole thing to actually take place automatically. And so that's in a nutshell what I wanted to talk about this evening. So the lesson at a high level is that obviously IoT has a lot of appeal, and there are lots of potential benefits and scenarios that on the surface seem to potentially have the potential to have the potential to add a lot of value to us, whether it's from a health perspective, a security perspective, energy consumption, traffic, and what have you. But these scenarios also rely very much on the need to enroll a very large number of players, people who are not necessarily going to be extremely sophisticated, be it in a context of development of devices or the development of services or the deployment of these technologies as well. And so that will lead to potentially a number of different security and privacy challenges. And one of the points I was trying to get across is that these developers just don't have really the resources, they don't have the sophistication, they don't have the scale to readdress these security issues and privacy issues on their own. And so there's really a need for these ecosystems themselves, the larger players, right, to offer people tools, protocols, and technology more generally to assist them when it comes to dealing with these security and these privacy issues. And so what I've done is I've shown you some technologies developed by others. We looked, for instance, at the MUD standard that has been proposed by Cisco to deal with some of the denial of service attacks that we talked about. And I've described to you also some technology that's being developed at Carnegie Mellon to help advertise IoT devices and their privacy practices and settings. And those registries have in some ways a similar philosophy as the one taken by MUD. They're a bit more complex to develop, but we've actually been able to not just prototype these technologies, but also deploy them in actual environments with real users. And we believe that ultimately these sorts of technologies will have to be adopted by these large ecosystems, because these issues of security and privacy, they really have the potential of hampering quite significantly the adoption of IoT. Right? We're talking about technologies that are not just going to crash. We're talking about potentially denial of service attacks of an amazing, unprecedented magnitude. We're talking about compromising devices that could put our lives at risk. So this is pretty serious, right? And it's going to have to be addressed properly if this technology is to actually see the day at a scale that's currently being envisioned by people. And so we've talked about tools to help developers articulate privacy policies, align these policies with what their technology is actually doing, and we've talked also about registries to publicize IoT resources and protocols to help people discover these resources and potentially configure settings. And that's where I want to stop. If there are any questions, I would be happy to try and answer them. Thank you very much.